Well, good afternoon and welcome to the AML talk show with me, Stephen Platt. I hope that wherever you are listening from, that you are safe and well and are enjoying seeing, as it were, the light get bigger at the end of this very, very, very long COVID tunnel. I'm delighted to have the opportunity today to welcome our guest, Mike Haley, to join me to discuss his role as the Chief Executive of CFAS in the UK, and more generally to engage in a dialogue about fraud and the position in relation to the finance industry's efforts to bear down on fraud risk in the UK, and the lessons that we might be able to learn as an AML community from the successes and failures of the industry in tackling fraud. Mike has been the Chief Executive of CFAS since May 2018. For those of you who don't know, CFAS is a not-for-profit fraud prevention membership organisation and the UK's leading fraud prevention service, managing the largest database of instances of fraudulent conduct in the country. CFAS member organisations are drawn from all sectors, not only financial services, of course, and they share their data across those sectors to reduce instances of fraud. It's a really, in my opinion, brilliant initiative. With over 30 years' experience of tackling and preventing fraud, Mike has been determined to bring together that strong cross-sectoral collaborative approach to the challenge of fraud prevention. He has a master's degree in criminology. He has led investigative teams in the National Health Service, the Ministry of Defence, the Office of Fair Trading, HM Revenue and Customs, and the Solicitors Regulation Authority. A wealth, clearly, then of relevant experience and subject matter expertise. He has also worked at the National Fraud Authority, directing cross-sector fraud prevention strategies. Mike believes, I know having spoken to him in the past, very passionately, that the battle against fraud is one that cannot be won alone. And by collaborating as a community, we can be much more effective in our efforts to put the spotlight on fraud, not only to protect each other, but also to make the UK a safer place to live and to do business. So Mike, after that, I'm afraid, rather lengthy introduction, but it was important to give our audience a really clear understanding of who you are and where you come from. After that rather long introduction, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing well, thank you, Stephen. And likewise, it's a pleasure to join you today and everyone at Risk Screen.
Well, thanks very much, Mike, for taking the time. I want to start, as I do with all of these interviews, by asking you just to tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and I guess, you know, in particular, what we're all interested in knowing is where your passion for tackling fraud comes from.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I think, like many people, when I left university, you look around for a job which is a stopgap before you find your real calling in life. And I immediately joined from university, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, as it was, Customs and Excise, as it was at the time. And I think after not very long, maybe 9 months as a VAT officer, I found a fraud. And my boss at the time said, you've really got a nose for it. In customs and excise, they say you have the revenue nose if you can sniff out when there's wrongdoing. And he was a great mentor in a way, in that he let me take that case on, investigate it, and I really cut my teeth in customs and quickly moved into the investigation division. And I think it was around pitting your wits against fraudsters, against organized crime. Because I was in London, North and West, it was mainly fraud rather than, we didn't have a port or airport in North and West London. So very rapidly got a taste for fraud. And that's where I think I found my calling. So I always think I cut my teeth in customs and then moved through very many different roles. I was at the NHS Counterfraud Service when it was started and had the London Regional Fraud Team under my remit. And then I had a kind of a twin track between regulatory roles, as you pointed out, the Office of Fair Trading. I was the head of consumer protection for about 8 years, 8-9 years, and there was a lot there, and also the Solicitors Regulation Authority. So risk and compliance and the fraud route kind of coming together. But I think where this has led me to is that you sometimes can get a bit jaded investigating or enforcing the same cases or types of cases and feel eventually, are you actually getting anywhere? And that's why I think CIFAS was such an amazing opportunity when I first joined as Deputy Chief Executive Officer 6 years ago, and now CEO for the last 3 years, that after a career investigation, you recognize that prevention is better than cure. And also that data-led approaches really provide the biggest opportunity to address the problem at scale. And I recall that when I got the CEO job, a colleague, another criminologist, said to me, what are you going to do with your new train set in terms of making a huge impact around fraud? And I think that CIFAS just has fantastic capabilities and an enormous network of members that can collaborate to defeat fraud. So my passion is bringing together organizations, bringing together interested parties, people who also have a passion for detecting fraud, for preventing fraud and tackling dishonesty, and giving them a vehicle to express themselves and make an impact.
Yeah, fascinating. Really, it's really interesting to hear about the background and in particular, that early experience, that early win that you had in your career in uncovering that fraudulent activity, which has clearly influenced, you know, your subsequent career path. Now, it's important, I think, Mike, and I hope you'll agree with this, it's important, I think, to say right at the outset that whilst fraud and money laundering are often talked about together, they are, of course, very different. And if we look at the continuum, I suppose, of criminality, fraud is a form of predicate crime that generates criminal property that is then the subject of money laundering. So, you know, fraud is a predicate crime for money laundering. Do you agree with that? Is that the way that you view these two issues?
Certainly. I would make a point that that wherever there's a fraud, generally there will be a need to launder the proceeds. So frauds can happen within financial institutions and then it's already there to be laundered. So I do see fraud and money laundering as best viewed as a continuum. But also, you're quite right, and it's something I read in the global, the financial crime news, global threat assessment that John Cusack brought together, I think, that where he points out that something like 50% of the money laundered around the world originates from a predicate offence of fraud. So it's a significant part of the money laundering issue, but it's a predicate offence. But also, because it's around fraud is a crime, an acquisitive crime to get hold of assets and money, it's already wrapped up in the financial institution. So I think there's a real intermingling of fraud and financial crime. And that's why I think that really, you know, that we need to bring the two worlds closer together within financial institutions, between those concerned with money laundering and those concerned with fraud.
A number of really, really interesting points that I want to dive into a bit further. Interesting that you quote John Cusack's paper. John does some great work in this space, and it's a fascinating figure. 50% of what's laundered is derived from fraud, which makes, as it were, the laundering detection challenge extremely difficult, because, as you say, the proceeds of fraud is generally already within the system. So it's very difficult to identify, for example, through looking at placement activity, because there is no placement activity, right? If you've committed a fraud, the money's already in a bank. That's very different to a situation in which somebody's smurfing money from drug trafficking activity or whatever into a financial institution. So there's less opportunity to prevent it from entering the system because, as you say, it's generated at the heart of the system.
And I think you can really see that with the biggest concern of many of our banking members around authorised push payment fraud, where you know, an individual is socially engineered to believe in a certain scheme or to send money to a safe account, to transfer money from an account which they control, which is definitely therefore set up on the basis of all the customer due diligence would say is that this is a genuine account, and then they're authorizing that payment, and then it's gone into another bank account now. So fraud is starting and there's no entry point. It's been transferred from an account that's already held and then to accounts which can be cashed out and are controlled by the criminal. And also, of course, we see that the accounts that they go through are often now accounts which are allowed to be used by account holders, the money mules. So it's now going into another account where it's not directly controlled by the criminal, but is being abused, an individual is being abused or allowing their account to be abused. So even then, with the you know, the layering effect, if you like, that's already going through accounts which again have been set up genuinely largely now. And I think it's quite a reaction to perhaps the success in the past of combating other types of fraud, that now that authorized push payment fraud and then the transfer through money mule accounts is all interlinked, and it's quite sophisticated.
Yes, very, very interesting. And of course, because laundering is predicated on fraud, as we've said, as the scale of the fraud problem grows, so clearly does the scale of the laundering problem that results from it. So there is a really powerful case, isn't there, for us to examine both of these issues, frankly, in partnership, as you say. Now, how do you feel, Mike, the finance industry? Let's just focus on the finance industry, if we may, because that's where most of our listeners are drawn from. How do you feel the finance industry in the UK is doing in tackling fraud? I mean, a bit of an unfair question, but how would you score it out of 10 if it were a student?
I'd probably give reasonably high marks of something like 7 out of 10. I think that from the outside of the financial institutions, it's easy to throw bricks at the financial institutions. And we see that very much around the kind of sterile debate that's going on around who pays for fraud, which tends to be the banks should step up and pay when someone has been a victim of a scam. And we've started to lose sight of actually, you know, the fraudster doesn't care who pays them, the criminal doesn't, whether that's the bank that loses out or the individual does. We should be concentrating on the fact that, you know, there's a crime underlying, there's a fraud that's underlying a lot of this money laundering. So I think that the financial institutions have invested quite heavily and continue to invest quite heavily in new technologies, in biometrics, in making sure that onboarding now uses faces, voices, looks at devices. So there are device recognition software that's been brought in. There's the data sharing schemes like ourselves. So there's a huge amount invested by financial institutions to prevent and detect fraud. But clearly it's an arms race, and fraud changes. And as soon as one technique is closed down, others open up. So I think that there needs to be continual investment. And perhaps this is one of the differences between fraud and money laundering, of course, because that fraud hits the bottom line. It's a cost of business. And if it goes above certain risk thresholds, which an institution thinks will affect its profitability, then it will invest more. Whereas, of course, money laundering, I think, is very much seen as a regulatory risk, and it's about reducing regulatory fines and sanctions more than dealing with the problem, I would say. So there are different incentives.
Yes, that's very interesting. And in fact, I want to come on and explore the question of incentives in a a great deal more detail with you. I mean, the scale of the fraud challenge is enormous, just as the scale of the AML challenge is enormous. And you know, I was looking at some figures yesterday about the value of the estimated value of frauds that have been committed in the UK, you know, during COVID, which has has been catnip for fraudsters, as you know, and you refer to it as an arms race. It is an enormous challenge, isn't it? And I think you're right. My impression certainly is that whilst the industry doesn't always get the credit I think it deserves for the efforts that it's making to combat fraud, those efforts really should be applauded given the scale of the challenge. Now, both fraud and money laundering are on the rise. We know that. They're at all-time highs. The consensus, certainly as far as AML is concerned, is that industry's not doing a very good job in tackling it. That from what you've said, it's perhaps a different story with fraud. Can I ask what's your impression of the way in which the finance industry is going about combating money laundering? Do you think you would score it 7 out of 10 in that regard as well?
Perhaps a little. Well, see, I guess the question I'd look at in a different way, rather than what the financial institution should be scored, and maybe look at a whole of system score, because yeah. I think some of the issues that are really faced by the industry in terms of tackling money laundering are the lack of, say, private to private intelligence sharing. So we know that suspicious activity reports go into the National Crime Agency and it's a one-way flow. Very little comes out of value, and very much goes in. There is kind of big gaping holes around information and intelligence sharing, whether that's around modus operandi, technologies, typologies, sharing of adverse incidents, transaction monitoring and sharing. I think on money laundering, there's a less mature industry than in fraud in terms of sharing that type of information. So, and I think that hinders the fight against money laundering within the UK. So I think, you know, when we look at that, the UK system as a whole, even with creations of initiatives such as the Gimlet, which started to look at how law enforcement and could supply back information, it's still on a very small scale compared to the size of the problem. And as I said, there's just a lack of that private to private data sharing, although there are some useful initiatives such as what are going on in the Netherlands at the moment around transaction monitoring across financial institutions. So I'd say that it's a lesser score, but I wouldn't say it's the fault of the financial institutions, of more of the regime that we have. And quite a lot of that is the lack of legal clarity about what can be shared, particularly private to private.
Yeah, that's a brilliant, it's a really, really interesting answer. You think that perhaps the part of the answer to what is perceived to be the lack of effectiveness of the AML regime in the UK is a symptom of that cultural difference in the way in which we approach fraud and money laundering, whereas with fraud you've placed at its heart data sharing as between institutions, and in the money laundering arena there's very little data sharing. In fact, it's just fraught with danger when it comes to the question of data, because of a lack of clarity around the rules. That's really interesting. Now we'll come back to that in a bit more detail in a moment. But you earlier alluded to motivations, and I wonder, just putting aside mechanisms for a moment, we'll come back to mechanisms. But I do wonder whether motivations are also an important part of why we continue to see so much scandal within, you know, the AML sphere. Is it because the motivations are different? You know, banks are tackling fraud to prevent commercial loss to themselves, as well as, of course, to others. But every fraud that takes place can hit their bottom line, whereas they're tackling money laundering not to prevent loss, but, as you said earlier, to comply with laws and regulations, and also, I guess, because they want to be good corporate citizens, and they realize it's not the right thing to do to help criminals benefit from their ill-gotten gains. But the motivations are clearly different. You know, one really hits them in the pocket, whereas the other one only hits them in the pocket if they are the victims of some enforcement action that's taken by a prosecutor or a regulator. You think there's something in that, do you?
I absolutely do. And I think also perhaps to bring in an elephant in a room is that you've painted the rosiest picture of the incentives of a financial institution in terms of its corporate social responsibility to tackle money laundering and to also be seen to doing the right thing. But of course, in itself, it can be a very profitable activity. Organized crime gangs, you know, are a big business. And we've seen that with institution after institution having failings internally because of the problem. You know, there are individual incentives, there are team incentives and organizational incentives for you know, funds to be flowing through the financial institutions, and we've seen that again and again. So despite what can be seen to be quite terrifying levels of fines, you know, very significant fines for regulatory failings when they've been found, it still doesn't seem to have rooted out some of that cultural and institutional overlooking of significant money laundering. You know, we've seen it for Mexican cartels, we've seen it for bribery and corruption around procurement frauds, you know. So, you know, there's been so many examples, and I'm not sure that, you know, whether the regulatory regime and that fining has absolutely changed the culture. So yes, in the best sense, many organizations want to do the right thing. Many actually end up not doing the right thing.
I mean, that's fascinating. What you're essentially saying, and I agree with you, Mike, is, you know, when with fraud prevention, there's no upside in turning a blind eye to fraud. Whereas you know, there is a potential upside to turning a blind eye, or at least paying lip service to AML. You know, if we look at the downside risk, it's not as great as it is with fraud, because it doesn't hit your bottom line. And worse than that, there is a real upside to not taking it terribly seriously, because you can boost profits, and that incentive operates at all levels, at an individual level, as you say, an executive level, and an organizational level. That is a really, really important point. I mean, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner, famously said, didn't he, you know, show me the incentive and I'll tell you the outcome. And if we look at recent cases like the Danske Bank case, like the NatWest case, which is obviously the first case in which the FCA is looking to prosecute for breach of the regulations. If you look at all of these money laundering cases, the anatomy or the taxonomy of these scandals is remarkably similar. I mean, you look at them and think, well, how on earth could that have happened, despite, you know, the massive investment that these organizations are said to have made in their AML control environments?
They have. You know, it's on record, isn't it, how many people work now and in transaction monitoring in money laundering teams, and also the investment in technologies to identify it. You know, there has absolutely been significant investment, and, you know, probably over the world, billions of pounds, and definitely hundreds of millions. And yet we still have the same scandals. I love that saying you just mentioned there from Warren Buffett's associate. You know, I do think incentives work. If you can get the incentive regime right, then behaviors will follow. I don't think it doesn't seem to me be quite right at the moment.
I mean, perhaps given that there will always be a very, very significant upside to, you know, turning a blind eye to dirty money and, you know, taking excessive risks. You know, do you think that we just simply have not got, you know, the jeopardy right? Do you think that the fine levels, do you think the punishments, the penalties are not sufficiently great to disincentivize that kind of conduct in the AML sphere?
I think it needs some serious thought, isn't it? Because I think we're probably at risk of violently agreeing that that jeopardy isn't quite high enough. But there have been eye-watering fines, but then I guess some of the institutions we talk about have eye-watering levels of profit in many years to be gone with. So maybe there's other you know, examples need to be set. There's, you know, there's a bank need to be literally closed down, or do there have to be such a reputational impact on an organization? So, you know, as we see now with NatWest, but will that mean that businesses won't bank with NatWest or individuals? I don't think so. I think it's seen as something which just is a regulatory problem. So yeah. I don't have the answer to that, but I do think it's worth this, you know, opening a debate about, you know, if we're going to collectively invest so much time, effort and money into the regime, and yet it doesn't seem to really land, then what would be the incentives? What would be the punishments? What would be the right regime to drive behaviours that will start having inroads into the money laundering problem?
Mm. I mean, what is fascinating, and what this discussion does shed light on, is that there is much that can be learnt by the AML world, as it were, from the anti-fraud world. That much is clearly evident. And you know, if you and I would both know that, you know, if you talk to the best teachers, you talk to the best parents, talk to anybody who's responsible for influencing behaviours, you know, they will tell you that, you know, wielding a big stick is not necessarily as effective as, you know, as winning hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. And what you've done extremely well in the anti-fraud space is that you've won hearts and minds, and you've brought industry together. And a big part of the reason for that is the mechanisms that you alluded to earlier that you have designed and have promoted. Now, what lessons from those mechanisms do you think we can learn, Mike?
Yeah, so I think that would be my starting point. Maybe the starting point is that when CIFAS was created by initially the retail credit industry, it was because a number of organizations recognized they were being hit by the same fraudsters again and again, and they weren't sharing that information amongst themselves. In fact, there's a history within our organization, or kind of founding story, if you like, that these credit industry, the retail credit industry came together, the fraud and financial crime managers there at that time in 1988, to put pressure on the police. They were saying to the police, what more can you do? That these criminals are just going from store to store with getting store cards and stealing our stuff, and it's the same people. What are you doing about it? Then, as now, the police said, well, we don't have enough resources to do it. You've got to solve this problem. So what are you doing about it? So they threw the problem back, and the industry said, okay, right, well, the police aren't going to solve this. They've thrown it back at us. What shall we do? And they said, well, they're identifying those fraudsters. We better start sharing. So the solution came from you know, those founding fathers, if you like, of the fraud industry, who came together and said, what do we need to be doing? What do we need to be sharing to be able to reduce the impact of these persistent and organized fraudsters? So that started off a process of leaving competition at the door, coming together and collaborating and recognizing that collaboration on sharing data, intelligence and knowledge was going to be the way forward. Now, it's taken time, of course. You know, that was 32 years ago. It started off with 8 organizations and now we have over 600. And it started off in the retail credit industry, but then the banks recognized, the card issuers recognized, and the loan industry, mortgages, all started recognizing that the fraudsters just didn't attack one industry. They attack wherever there's money. Wherever they can get value, they will attack. And therefore, they're seeing the same fraudsters or the same across the industries. And so it's taken time, and each new industry, as it sees a fraud problem, looks around for a solution. And we already have that infrastructure created. So now we have telcos in membership. We've started to take on the online gambling industry or the gambling industry, who at certain stage of maturity start to recognize they must share data amongst themselves, like say the insurance industry does with the Insurance Fraud Bureau. And then at second level maturity, there is, we should be sharing across sector, because if we silo our data and silo our intelligence, then that's not how criminals operate. And I think the next level of maturity will be global data sharing, because fraud and financial crime are global industries. So I think absolutely one's creating a community which leaves competition at the door. Secondly, I think we have got a real advantage because of that longevity, that our sharing fraud, sharing data for fraud for purposes of preventing, detecting fraud is recognized in the Data Protection Act. It's recognized in the European legislation, the GDPR. There's recital 47, which talks about the legitimate interests of business to process personal data. And an example is given is for preventing fraud. So there is, because I think we've been around and made that argument, the legal provisions have followed, which enables the data sharing. And thirdly, I think there is just an issue of, if you put in place a scheme of good data governance and security, you can create trust that this can be done at a low risk to the participating organizations. So we've been doing it for 32 years now, so it doesn't come overnight, but it is a model, I think, that is needed in financial crime more widely, money laundering specifically, to really start turning the tide, identifying money laundering and doing something about it. But this wasn't, this came from industry. It wasn't imposed on industry by regulation. And I think that's a real big difference. And I would say, what the industry came up with in fraud is more successful than a regulatory regime imposed by a government.
Yes. Fascinating answer, that. And so if we contrast that with what we see in the money laundering sphere, you know, there are two major issues there, Mike, aren't there? Number one, you know, you used the phrase there a couple of times, we leave competition at the door. You recognize as sort of, you know, anti-fraud specialists, as a community, that a rising tide, you know, lifts all boats. As an economy, you know, we're only as strong as our weakest anti-fraud link, as it were. It's imperative that you work together as a collective to fight it. Now that's enviable. We just simply don't see that in the AML space. In fact, you know, what we see, despite the best efforts of a lot of very well-meaning people, we actually, you know, I think sometimes see AML failure as an element of competition. You know, if a bank gets whacked with a $6 billion fine, well, hey, you know, that's a cost of doing business, and they're going to have to suffer that. And no, it's part of the game, right? And we're all in this, you know, competing for a bigger share of the market slice as we can get. So that's the first thing. It's one of attitude. It's one of community. And then the second point that you make is around mechanisms. Whereas the law provides for data sharing mechanisms in the fraud prevention space, it does the opposite when it comes to AML. You know, we people are scared stiff of tipping off offences and goodness knows what else. And so this militates against information sharing. And as a consequence, you know, that rising tide, that tide that I mentioned earlier, is, you know, is never going to rise. How do we address this, do you think? I mean, what we seem to be saying here is that the problems are systemic, and we need government to begin to legislate differently in order to encourage, you know, different behaviours through legal mechanisms.
I absolutely agree. And there are actually some green shoots of, you know, what's possible here, because the Home Office does recognise that needs to be a testing of the current data protection legislation to see whether there can be the similar types of fraud data sharing for financial crime, and for us to resolve some of those tensions between POCA and GDPR. Yes. And how that is being operated, there's a pilot going to be run this year by CIFAS, but it's actually on behalf of UK Finance and the Home Office. So we're providing the technology platform, if you like, and our expertise in data governance and data processing. But UK Finance is taking the lead of bringing together organisations, bringing together the banking community to explore how can we do this in a way which is legally compliant, resolve those tensions between tipping off and the transparency agenda of data protection legislation. It's going to be conducted in the ICO's sandbox. So I think this gives us a real opportunity to find out, can we do it under existing legislation, or does there need to be a change to UK legislation? And the Home Office will lead that. So I think we've got a really good chance to resolve this kind of very fundamental issue around how can you get such a scheme of sharing private to private, and within the UK, which people are confident to actually participate in, because there'll be a firm legal basis for it. I think that really just does hold everyone back from doing what they would like to do and what they think is right in terms of tracking money laundering. You need to be able to see both ends of a transaction to really identify whether there is a genuine risk of money laundering. And I think it could actually be really helpful for individuals. We see so many defensive SARs that are put in, and that could really affect an individual. Because we're now sharing information on a suspicion, where if we shared information, we could actually say, well, that looks like a perfectly reasonable transaction. There's no suspicion there if you see both ends. So you could end up, this actually could be helping to reduce the risk to individuals or innocent parties, because we are sharing more. So I think it's not just about identifying when it's a genuine money laundering concern, but it would also be protecting innocent parties. So I think there's a lot to be gained. This pilot should be kicking off later this year. But it is with a view to seeing, does our legal regime, is it the best it could be to enable this sharing? You know, do we need a free one, 4B, like in the US, or do we need to have something equivalent or better? Or can we do it under existing legislation? We just haven't had the confidence to do it.
It's a brilliant initiative, Mike, and I'm going to be very interested to see what the upshot of it is. I mean, I've always been sceptical of the FATF model and its relevance and applicability in certain parts of the world with stark cultural differences to the jurisdictions that are the principal sponsors of the FATF model and approach. And I think that not including a requirement for jurisdictions to have legislative models and mechanisms to encourage private information sharing on money laundering is a glaring omission from the FATF model. Are you seeing any leadership around this kind of initiative emerging from international standard setting bodies like the FATF, or is this purely a domestic Home Office led initiative?
So at the moment, it's a home office and domestic initiative, and I'd have to take my hat off to Nick Lewis of Standard Chartered, who's really pushed this agenda. But I do think if we can, we also see through Roos's Future Financial Intelligence Sharing Programme that, you know, there is a lot of good practice in different parts of the world. And I mentioned in the Netherlands, there's been a couple of initiatives around transaction monitoring sharing. So yes. At the moment, it seems to me it's in different jurisdictions wrestling with that problem rather than a supranational body such as FATF taking the lead. But I could be put wrong with that, and maybe they'll pick that up once they see some examples of this being effective. But you know, I'd recommend anyone to look at the work by Roosie on the comparisons of intelligence and public-private partnerships around the world too.
Yeah, and Roosie do some terrific work in this area. Tom Keating in particular is a superstar in this area, and this is, I'm sure, something that, you know, we should raise with, you know, David Lewis, Executive Secretary of the FATF, who's been a guest on this show. I'm sure that David would be very, very interested in this kind of initiative and its outcomes.
I'd add to that is the sometimes the timing of these things, you know, technological developments such as privacy enhancing technology, which is now being more widely utilized, wasn't there in the past. So, you know, it could suddenly become a way for that type of data sharing to be more prevalent because some of the concerns around sharing customer data, for example, can be reduced.
Yes, yes. Now, look, Mike, for the benefit of our listeners in the AML space, I want to just dig a little bit deeper, if we may, into understanding more about the sort of granular work of CFAS. In facilitating the data sharing that you're referring to. How does this work? Do organizations literally on this peer-to-peer platform, as it were, do they share their suspicions, concerns about individuals, or does it also extend to learnings from root cause analyses that are conducted internally so that, you know, they're spreading information about fraud methodologies? You know, what sort of data is being shared amongst your members?
So I'd probably approach it. We have three different tools that we provide to a membership. One is the National Fraud Database. So this is a utility of shared fraud cases. Secondly, we then have what we call our member portal, which is a secure platform for peer-to-peer discussions, sharing of intelligence, sharing of new modus operandi, and to be asking each other questions. And then we have something called Fraud Check, which is now on a digital basis, where if you have a match in the data to another organization, you can be put in touch with your equivalent in the other financial or other membership institution. So, but the core is the National Fraud Database, and I explain a little bit how that works. So that takes in primarily, or the biggest amount of, or the greatest useful data is when a member finds a case of fraud, it will then, it's obliged under our rules, which are based on a core principle of reciprocity. So if you join CIFAS and are a member of the National Fraud Database, you're obliged to put the frauds that you discover into the database if you're going to get the benefit of being able to access that data. So what would happen if a member discovers a fraud? It will file a case to the National Fraud Database. It will be, generally, it will have information about the individual, their name, address, date of birth, their address, their financial details, their contact details, email address, mobile phone numbers. It could have documents attached to it, identity documents, pay slips, depending on the type of fraud and the sector that the organization's in. And it must meet a standard of proof before a case is filed. So that a standard of proof is that the member needs to be sure that a fraud has been attempted or conducted. They don't have to report that to the police. We actually report, we supply all that information that comes in on a daily basis to the National Fraud Intelligence Bureau. It's not reaching a standard beyond reasonable doubt. It's just that they have to, they were sure it's a fraud. They must have sufficient evidence that a fraud has been taken, and they must have taken an action such as ending the facility, closing an account, rejecting an application. Then that data is immediately available to all the rest of the membership in real time. So you can search against it. And how members tend to do that is on their onboarding process. One of the checks will be to check everything, say in an application to open a bank account, against every element of that data against the database. And so, and we have a set of data matching rules. It's a rules-based system, which will then say, is it the same individual, same addresses? Is it same contact details, same bank account with some fuzzy matching? And it will come back and say what data matching rules have been fired or not. So it could come back and say this email address has been seen in frauds three times in the last week. Therefore, you might want to take a look at this application to see whether you want to continue with that application. So we call it confirmed fraud. That fraud is, are you sure it's fraud? It doesn't have to be a standard beyond reasonable doubt. And once it's there, it's searched against. It's kind of now inbuilt into a lot of the onboarding process, account opening processes of most of our members. It can also be used as an investigative tool to be able to search on any element that's in that data. So that's the bulk of that data. I think we have something like 700,000 individuals on there, 2.5 million email phone numbers, 1.5 million emails, and then several million other records which come from different sources. For example, Operation Amber Hill is a Metropolitan Police unit that looks at identity fraud. And if they raid an identity factory and find that different documents have been created, identity documents for fraudulent purposes or for any purpose, but they're fraudulent documents, that's also loaded. So you'll see that there's lots of a rich database of information to be searched against in real time. So there's a national fraud database, and that's how that operates. If a member makes a match against it, they can access the case that the first member filed, and if they need to speak to them, they can use our fraud check system and then have an A to B conversation about, well, what did you see? What more information do you have? To be able to make a risk-based decision about whether to onboard a customer or whether to reject a customer. So it's both sharing intelligence through the portal, where we share the different typologies, modus operandi, what's going on intelligence, and then there's actual fraud data in the National Fraud Database.
Very, very interesting. It's a brilliant mechanism. It really is. And clearly, there is a huge volume of highly valuable data there that you are you're hosting and facilitating access to by your members, which is brilliant. You talked earlier, Mike, about the sort of third level of maturity, which is international cooperation, which must be right because, you know, like money laundering, fraud doesn't respect boundaries or borders. What ambitions does CFAS have in that regard?
So our ambitions are big on that scale. I would say that just a reflection on, we've been reflecting what can be learnt in financial crime and money laundering from fraud. I think that actually there's a mature system of international cooperation through FATF and other organisations on money laundering and international standards. We don't have anything similar at all on fraud. So, you know, we're way behind on that globalised picture of the fraud problem. And yet, because of technologies and the internet, you know, you could sit in Kiev and make hundreds of applications to financial institutions in the UK using data you've found or on dark websites. So we need to be able to get better on a global basis. So what our ambitions are is that at the moment there are only two other organisations similar to CFAS in the world, one in South Africa, which we helped set up, and one in Australia, the Australian Criminal Financial Finances Exchange. And we cooperate with them, but we've not yet reached the level of being able to share data because of different legal bases of that we have in the three different jurisdictions. We are we're contracted to create a shared full database for the Banking and Payments Federation of Ireland, and they're going through the process of getting their Department of Justice and their data commissioner on board, and we're helping in the Netherlands to create a CIFAS like structure or shared fraud database on the basis of our technology and rules. So I see in the future we need to be creating as many CIFASs as we can in different jurisdictions, and then starting to join up those data sets and being able to compare them. That may well be we could do that through using privacy enhancing technology to get around the difficulties of the different legal underpinnings of on data protection. But I think we could also take a leap and start thinking, how can we start sharing data between global companies and global banks, particularly through merchants? You know, there is so much data now available, particularly for the big tech companies. And I think we might take a leap from trying to create, you know, 200 CIFASs, one every few years, to actually, can we crack a global data sharing scheme, maybe based on this privacy enhancing technology? It's not, for me, just like a dream. It's like a necessity, because fraud is such a global industry, and we could just displace it, you know, where the individuals who are behind it and the organized crime gangs are, to someone outside of our jurisdiction. We've seen that through policing have given up in some instances because the perpetrators are overseas. We can't sit back and let that happen. It's a tough road to go down though, Stephen, as you can imagine. But even this afternoon, I'm having discussions with global merchants around how we can create such a global exchange of fraud data. But, you know, so that is absolutely our ambition, and because it's a necessity in the global age.
Yes, I totally agree. Well, Mike, we wish you all the very best in your ambitions to allow other countries around the world to benefit from the expertise and the mechanisms and the specialisms that you've developed at CIFAS. I'm very, very conscious of time. So on behalf of our live listeners and all those many more listeners who will download the podcast, thank you very much for sparing the time, Mike. I know how busy you are. It was a genuinely insightful discussion, and there clearly is very much that the AML community can learn from the fraud prevention community and from CIFAS in particular. To the extent that KYC 360, as the global AML knowledge portal, with now about 50,000 regular AML professional users, to the extent that we can help you with that in the realization of those ambitions, as it were, for the greater good, then I am sure that we will do all that we can in that regard. Thank you all for listening. This podcast will be available on KYC 360 and on a variety of other platforms during the next 24 hours. But for now, stay safe, stay well, and I look forward to speaking to you all again in our next AML talk show. Goodbye.